Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Today we have an author that's written a book, The Potato Masher Murder. Death at the Hands of a Jealous Husband. Now, I love that name. It really, that's what stuck out for me. That's why I had to grab this guy. The author who has a personal connection to the story is Gary Sosnicki. How you doing?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
Hey, I think I got the name right.
You did.
Hey.
Uncommon.
Wow. So now this is a true crime story that's, I guess, part of really your family in a sense. First of all, what was the, catalyst? Like, what actually started you on this journey to find out about this story?
Well, this was my great-grandmother, Cecilia Henderson Hornburg Ludwig. She was married twice. And the Hornburg side of the family was my family. She would have been my mother's grandmother. And growing up at family gatherings, Christmas and Thanksgiving and birthdays and so forth, my little brother and I, we would hear whispers about that this woman in the family had been murdered. And some of the comments wouldn't be terribly complimentary toward her. And we didn't really know much about it. And I always thought that this was something I wanted to know more about someday. Well, I became a newspaper reporter when I grew up, later an editor and a publisher. And around the time that the internet came into being, which made research a little bit easier, I said, this is something I want to find out about. I want to research family trees on both sides of the family. So I finally got my mom to talk about this in 1996. And she told me a little bit about the murder. She didn't have the setting right. She didn't have the town right. She didn't have the year right. But she was close in all cases. So I found the name of a historian in LaPorte County, Indiana, which is where her family, my mother's family, had come from. And so I wrote the historian and said, hey, I'm trying to find something about a murder. And this was the name. It was Cecilia Hornburg. And I think it happened in 1905. I think it happened in LaPorte. And if you can find anything, you know, please let me know. And of course, in this day and age, we're doing snail mail. I'm typing letters. I hear back from her, and she said, I can't find anything. And I talked to my mom again, and she said, well, maybe it would be the next year. And that. So we tried the next year. And the researcher, Fern Eddy Schultz, who is still on the job as the state-appointed historian in LaPorte County, Indiana, she hit pay dirt. She found stories in the two LaPorte daily newspapers about the murder, even though it didn't occur in LaPorte. She discovered that it occurred in Mishawaka, Indiana, on September 25th, 1906. And she sent me my first newspaper clippings. Now, the bonus in dealing with Fern was at the same time, Fern got a letter, snail mail, from a distant cousin of mine who I didn't know existed, Paula Steiner, who lived in California. And Paula was interested in the murder, too. So Fern connected the two of us, and we began a correspondence. So besides getting help from Fern and getting some initial newspaper clippings to find out about the murder, which was big, big news in Northern Indiana, I met the first through, met by virtually and through mail, I met the first relative who knew some anecdotal stories about the murder too. So I was on my way.
Wow. So what was being said? What you said there was whispers. So first of all, what kind of whispers were going around? Like who, what were they saying about her? Like was it that she, kind of, fill us there. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, there were some references to her being Miss Indiana, to her. There was something else that was sarcastic that I can't think of at the moment. But they were sarcasm, and I didn't really understand that. Well, this was a relative, and she was murdered. So why do they feel this way? Well, after I learned more about Cecilia, I can understand that, and the connection from the family, I can understand that because this was a Cecilia did not have the best reputation. We'll talk about it sure in a little bit.
Wow, geez. So let's talk about the story. So what exactly did you find out about her?
Well, I found that Cecilia was a victim of domestic violence in both her marriages. Now that's something that is inexcusable. Her first marriage broke up. First Cecilia was 7 months pregnant. And 15 years old when she married my great-grandfather. So, that's not a good way to start a marriage, 15 and 7 months pregnant. Yeah. So, they had a second child, Lyle, a daughter, 2 years later. But she divorced my great-grandfather and charged him with cruel and inhumane treatment. And according to the divorce decree, which Fern Schultz found for me in LaPorte, he had beaten her at times with a steel pipe and had held a gun to her head and so forth, and it was a justified divorce. Now, there weren't any, I don't have a transcript or anything of the divorce case, so I don't really know if she did anything to cause this to happen. But I know in the second marriage, which came a few years later to Albin Ludwig, and that is A-L-B-I-N, B as in boy, not Alvin, as you might expect. I know that Cecilia was a bit of a runaround, and Cecilia had a reputation to gad about town, and Albin caught her in some compromising positions. Once Albin came home from work, Albin was working at the shoe factory in Mishawaka, Indiana, and he came home from work early because he'd forgot his pocket watch, And he found, so this is about 7:15 in the morning, and he found Cecilia's clothes on the bed and couldn't find Cecilia. And he looked around, and in the northwest bedroom on the opposite side of the house, he found Cecilia in the closet with a boarder. So Albin, when he told this story, he never said whether or not they were dressed or not, but the implication was that he found them in, at least partially undressed in the closet, because Cecilia's clothes were sitting on the bed. So that was one of several instances where Cecilia was getting about town.
So how was she in that marriage? Like, was he rough as well with her?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, they both had ferocious tempers. And some of the language in the book is fairly strong when there are references to each other in the book. Both threatened to kill each other at various times. She threatened to poison Albin several times. The witnesses testified to that, or knock his block off. And Albin, just a week before the murder, had told Cecilia's mother that if she left him, he would kill her. So, you know, this was not a good marriage. And Albin had a ferocious temper, and so did Cecilia.
Well, okay, so back then, but we're talking in the early 1900s.
Right, 1900s.
Right, so I couldn't imagine. So there was a different thought towards a woman, right?
Yeah.
A female was more of a possession, in a sense, like you own them now that they're married to you. It's
not. Right.
So did she really have a defense of saying that, you know, he beat me or he's cruel? You know what I'm saying? Isn't that kind of something that people took for granted?
Yeah, and I write about this in the last chapter. Or maybe it's in the epilogue. I was surprised to learn that wife beating was acceptable in America through the 1860s. I think it was the first case where it wasn't acceptable was in 1872, and it surprised me. It was in Alabama where there was another Alabama. I've got good friends there, and enjoy the beaches in Alabama, but. That kind of surprised me that was the first case where a man got into trouble for beating his wife. And you know, it's still even after that, the courts and authorities and neighbors kind of looked the other way. So this was right at the time, or maybe there was there'd be the modern woman, where it became or you really couldn't do that as easily as you could before. And it's terrible. And I've been asked, you know, what's the main message in the book? And I think the main message is one of domestic violence and extreme domestic violence. And I think that how awful it can be. And I, you know, fortunately today there are places where victims of domestic violence can turn. In our town, there's an agency called COPE, where you can help women who have been abused to go and I don't want to say hide out, but basically hide out and get help and get training for jobs and so forth. And Cecilia didn't have that option. But I'm not sure she would have wanted to be closed up anyplace, because she was having too good a time.
Yeah, it kind of, without knowing her, it almost sounds like she was giving out as much as she was getting.
He was. Yeah, and she knew how to push all of Albin's buttons. You know, Albin was 7 years older than Cecilia, and actually Cecilia was bigger than her. Cecilia weighed, I think, 165 and was about 6'10", I'm sorry, 5'10", and 5'11". Her dad was 6'7", and Albin was a good 3 inches shorter, so I'm sure she could be intimidating to him.
Well, so what was their situation? Were they living well? Were they both working? Like, did they have a lot of money? No money? Were they? Do you know anything about their situation?
I do. Yeah. Alban had. They're both immigrant families. Cecilia's family came from Scotland early 1880s and settled in Kingsbury, which is a little town south of LaPorte in Indiana. This whole story occurs in northern Indiana, a part of the state referred to as Michiana because it's the tier of counties right below Michigan. And they settled in Kingsbury. And the Ludwig family, Alban's family, came about the same time, 1880s, and settled in Elkhart, Indiana, which is two counties over. So Cecilia is divorced from her first husband, and for a while she lives in a boarder in a house where one of her sisters is a domestic. And then about 1900, 1901, she gets a job as a domestic for Reverend Townsend in Elkhart. So that would be two counties over. So she has moved two counties over. So meanwhile, we've got Alban. And Alban had worked as a teamster for the city of Elkhart. But at 1901, he decides to buy a tavern. And it's called the Monument Saloon. And I think it was one of 25 taverns in Elkhart at the time, which to me, that if you've never been in business before, that can be kind of intimidating to have that kind of competition in a smaller city. So Alban was not terribly successful at the saloon. It was right downtown. It was at the main close to the main intersection of downtown Elkhart. There's a bank there now, but he wasn't terribly successful, and it had been said that he pretty much broke him running the saloon. So somehow he and Cecilia met. And I can't figure out how they met, because it wouldn't have been proper for a woman to go into a saloon in 1900, 1901, although I suppose that Cecilia might have thought it had been proper, but it wouldn't have been proper. I'm thinking that perhaps they met at church, because Alban said that he was a good church worker. So that could be how they met. So they got married, and they moved in with Alban's mother. Alban's father was a farm laborer and had died of sunstroke working in a cornfield a few years earlier. So they moved in with Alban's mother, and that didn't work real well, because Cecilia was accused of striking her mother-in-law 1 week, and then 10 days later striking her sister-in-law who lived next door. So I may have the order mixed up of which she did first, but the mother-in-law booted them out of the house. So they got another house in Elkhart until they sold the saloon, and they moved 11 miles west to Mishawaka. Now, for your listeners who aren't familiar with Mishawaka, Indiana, I'm sure they're all familiar with South Bend, Indiana, the home of Notre Dame. And Mishawaka today is kind of a twin city of Notre Dame. The two cities have grown together, but at one time they were a few miles apart. And Mishawaka is much smaller than South Bend. They're both on the St. Joseph River, though. So Alban and Cecilia bought a home in a new neighborhood at what then was the north edge of Mishawaka, and a pretty nice neighborhood. I think they were paying $10 a month. They weren't paying very much on the home. And Alban got a job at the shoe factory, and he got in trouble a few times at the shoe factory for his temper, and apparently he wasn't very popular with employees. So, these guys both have ferocious tempers. And a point I like to make about the book: there are no heroes in the book. It's a fascinating story of a marriage gone bad, two marriages gone bad, and a particularly gruesome murder. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is the scene of what happens up to really a few months before the murder.
Well, you know, go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to ask, I mean, one thing, you know, often with like domestic abuse is there's a lot of sort of psychological grooming or build up to the events that often get reported, like the violence and that kind of thing. And I know you're like looking back on this case, you know, many, many years ago, was it hard to sort of try to figure out how to represent that in your book, or did you struggle with that idea? I'm just curious.
You know, as a newspaper reporter, and I tried to be as objective as I could and do a lot of research over the years. And heck, it took 24 years for me to get the thing finished, you know, starting and stopping. It wasn't until I retired that I really got going on it. So I tried to be objective and tell the story as objectively as I could, as I always have, and keep doing research until I thought I had enough for a book. You know, I didn't struggle with it. I was just telling the story with both sides of the story.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. What? I'm a fiction writer, so I'm always kind of thinking, what's the psychological motivation? That's where I'm going.
Yeah, and I don't think I could write fiction after 43 years in newspaper. It would be very, very hard. I envy you. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, I don't understand it myself. I interview a lot of fiction writers, and I can't figure this out, but, you know. What happened to the kids? Because you said that she had two kids with the first husband, your great-grandfather. So did she bring them with her to the new marriage? Were they around during all of this?
The boy, my grandfather, William Hornburg, he went with the father. And the father, Charlie Hornburg, they went into southern Michigan. The daughter, Lyle, spent half the time with Cecilia and Albin in Mishawaka, and the rest of the time in Kingsbury with her grandparents. And I know this is at one point a neighbor in Mishawaka wrote the grandmother in Kingsbury and said, you need to come and get your granddaughter, because she is outside in the front yard until 6 o'clock at night until someone comes home, because the father's working and the mother is never around. So yeah, let me tell you, let me lead into what really started things tumbling, as if they weren't tumbling already. And since you mentioned kids, and that would be in June of 1906. That's when Cecilia's younger sister, Jean, moved into the house with her two kids. So you've got a 9-year-old girl, and you've got a little boy who's not quite 7, so he's 6. And you have a woman, 4 years younger than Cecilia, but Cecilia had several sisters. And Jean had abandoned her husband in Nevada, where he was a mining engineer in the gold industry. And so she had left her husband. So she was kind of an actor in that, that she got, she gave Cecilia the opportunity to spend more time away from home. Cecilia and Jean, ran around town, ran around Mishawaka, ran around South Bend, all summer. And, This was tough on Albin, because he'd say, he would complain to her, you know, I don't mind if you go out, but I want to go out with you. I never get to go out with you. You're going out all the time with your sister, and you're going to South Bend and every day. And you know, if I could go out with you 3 times a week, or if I could go out with you on Sundays or something, I'd like that. And you know, that didn't happen. So Jean's appearance really was a trigger. There was a man by the name of Fred Young, who was from Kingsbury, and I think he was 23 years old. So he was probably closer to Gene's age than to Cecilia's, but he was working in Mishawaka, and he was a widower, and he began hanging out at the house, and he'd come over for dinner, and he'd come over to see the women, and Albin thought that Fred was having an affair with Cecilia. And my impression is that Fred probably had a thing going with Gene. I don't know how much of a thing, you know, if it was a true affair, but I think that's what was going on. And Fred always claimed it, well, he claimed in the trial that he was coming to visit Mrs. Ellsworth. He always referred to her as Mrs. Ellsworth. But this was again, it was another setup in the murder. And the night before the murder is when things really started turning bad.
Well, what exactly happened where he actually, I know some of the story here, but what do you think made him go over the edge where he was going to actually kill her?
I think it started the night before. The night before, they had been gone. Cecilia and Jean had been gone in the afternoon shopping for shoes. And they were only home for about an hour, just about long enough for them to cook dinner. And they had dinner, and then they took off again. And they told Albin that they were going to the drugstore to get some iodine and glycerin, which Cecilia used to treat her sore feet. And Cecilia asked Albin for a bottle, a medicine bottle, which he cleaned out and gave her. And so they took off, and Albin was terribly suspicious. So he followed them that night, and he followed them surreptitiously. That's a word I like, surreptitiously. he followed them to the drugstore, and watched from across the street and saw that they got the bottle filled with the medicine. And instead of coming back home, they took off toward downtown Mishawaka, which is across the St. Joseph River. And that's a 15-minute walk from the house. I know because I have walked it to time it. So they're going across the river to the what was called the Four Corners of Mishawaka in those days. It was the intersection of Main Street and Second Avenue, which today is known as Lincoln Way. So they go to that intersection, and Albin is also at that intersection, and they still haven't seen him. So Albin is underneath an awning on the southeast corner, and he's watching the women. The women come down on the east side of the street, and they peek into a tavern through the window, and then they go across the street, and they meet a man on the northwest corner of the intersection. And this man, all we know is his name is Ackerman, and a good-looking young man, but they meet Ackerman, and we know that he worked on the Mishawaka Bridge. And so Albin referred to him as a bridge man. Well, Albin was, you know, insanely jealous. In fact, a week before, he'd gone to the newspapers in South Bend and wanted them to do a story about his wife being a runaround, which came out after the murder. So Albin was insanely jealous, and he saw this going on. Well, he noticed a policeman by the name of James Anderson leaning against a telegraph pole on the corner. So he goes up to the policeman and says, "Do you know who those women are?" And he points to them across the street, kitty corner across the street. And it's dusk now on this Monday evening. And the policeman walks into the intersection and comes on back and says,
"Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads."
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, I know that's your wife and her sister. I see them around town all the time. And, of course, I'm sure that Alban's thinking, yeah, I know you do, because that's where they are all the time. So Alban tells the policeman, I am going to put a stop to that. And if anything happens, I want you to remember it. And, you know, that certainly sounds like a threat. So the policeman suggests that Alban go on home. Well, Alban went on home, but he also saw the women go up to, with Ackerman in tow, go up to a boarding house about half a block north. And at that boarding house, Ackerman went in and got Fred Young. So it's another appearance by Fred Young. So Fred Young and the two women walk back to the house. And again, this is probably about 8 o'clock at night. And so they're back at the house, and there's some quarreling going on, of course, because Alban wants to know who they were talking to, and the women deny that they were even went that far. And so they quarrel off and on for the rest of the evening, I think till about 11 o'clock before Fred leaves. And Alban is just beside himself. He goes next door and talks to a neighbor. Alban has male friends on both sides of the house. And he goes, talks to a neighbor, and the neighbor tries to get him to calm down. And there is some talk that Gene is going to leave the next day, and that perhaps Cecilia might go too. But there's no decisions made. So that leads to the day of the murder, the next morning.
So, yeah, this is interesting because, so in your mind, after that kind of a night and their history, did you think it was in Albin's brain to actually want to kill her?
I don't think so. Alban claimed continuously, even after she was dead, that he loved her, and he didn't want her to leave, and he claimed that he would put up with this. Alban told her, and I don't remember if it was that night or the morning of the murder, and said, you know, if you want to leave and go to South Bend for a week like you do at times, and come on back, that's fine. I would welcome you back, but if you're going away permanently, then I'm going to sell everything. I'm going to give back the house and so forth. And that was a bone of contention with with Cecilia, because Alvin said you would get half of the proceeds from selling everything, and she wanted everything.
Hmm. Why would she think she can get everything?
Yeah.
Well, she could be pretty intimidating, and that was part of the final fight that they had the next day.
Yeah. So they got up the next day and they just got into a fight right off the bat, or did they make up first?
Well, Cecilia wasn't sleeping in the same bedroom with Alvin. Cecilia was sleeping in the bedroom next door with her sister. And the women got up early, and Alvin, I find this curious, he slept to 9 o'clock in the morning before he got out of bed. And, you know, if I'd been under this kind of stress, you know, I would have been up most of the night. But Alvin slept to 9 o'clock in the morning, and then he was kind of ticked off that they didn't make breakfast for him. And later on, he admitted, well, Cecilia hadn't made breakfast for him for a year. So that was kind of a false statement. But they had a few quarrels that morning, but Cecilia said she had decided to leave, and Jean was leaving. Cecilia said that she would leave if she had a trunk. Well, Alvin said, I will give you my trunk. But again, you don't have to leave. You know, I love you. I'd like you to stay, or I'd like you to come back. So this would go off and on, and there wasn't really any violence at that point. But Cecilia went upstairs and did some packing, and Jean went upstairs to her room and did some packing. And normally they have the noon meal, that they call dinner, and they'd have that around noon. But I think it was 11:30 when Celia said that sent Alvin on an errand that she needed gasoline for the cook stove. And this is something that just amazes me, that gasoline cook stoves were so common in that era. I don't know if you guys in your research have found that out, but I was just appalled. I mean, can you imagine lighting gas? And I guess it was a different type of gasoline, not the mixture that we put in,
right.
Put in my old pickup, but gasoline cook stove. So Alvin went to the grocery store to buy gasoline and bought 2 gallons of gasoline. He also bought himself a bottle of brandy at another store, at the drugstore. He bought the brandy and came back home, and they put a little bit of the gasoline into the cook stove. And you know, that's an important point for later on, that there was still some gasoline left. And then Alvin went next door to one of his man friends, and the wife was there too. And this friend was also named Fred. It was Fred Metzger. And he said, Fred, I'm going to kill myself. And Cecilia is leaving, and I just can't stand this. And Fred says, look, said, you need to go see a lawyer. I'll go with you to see a lawyer. Well, who are we going to see? And they decide which lawyer they're going to go see. Alvin didn't go to work that day. He didn't go to the shoe factory that day. So, but Fred was going to work. So he said, when I come home from work today, we'll go see this lawyer. Don't kill yourself. You know, go see this. So he goes back home. And dinner is ready. They had boiled meat and potatoes and bread and butter and some gravy. Boiled meat was a common meal for immigrant families. It was popular with immigrant families. And I saw in the newspapers that you could buy boiled meat that was advertised. So they had dinner. And now you get to where the stories separate. Jean has left. And the stories agree on that. So you've got Alvin and Cecilia and the two kids eating dinner. Now, what happens next is where we've got the big mystery. A potato masher is involved in both scenarios, but two different scenarios about what happened next.
Obviously it's his story and someone else's story. Is there one that you sort of buy into more?
I think they are both plausible stories up to a certain point. The prosecution story is that Albin grabbed a potato masher out of the kitchen and chased Cecilia upstairs, knocked her in the head, dragged her into the closet, went downstairs at some point and got a tin can full of gasoline or kerosene, brought it upstairs, poured it on Cecilia, and set her on fire. He then closed the closet door, put a rocking chair in front of the closet, and sliced himself up with a straight razor. He had wounds on his neck, on his arms, on his wrists. He had a deep wound on his calf. It went 3 inches deep, almost to the bone. There is some difference of opinion whether he started cutting himself up before he went downstairs to get the gasoline and the kerosene, or whether he just had, whether he started it or whether he did it all afterwards. But there's got to be some explanation for the blood that was found throughout the house, on the banister of the stairs and on the door jams and so forth. So that's one side of the story. Albin's side of the story was that he got sick to his stomach after drinking coffee that tasted peculiar. Cecilia had served him coffee at the dinner table, and Albin wondered if he had been poisoned, since that was a threat that Cecilia had made before. So Albin's story is that then he didn't feel good. He went out onto the porch and sat for a while, and it was starting to really feel sick, like he might throw up or might have to defecate. And he goes out to the backyard and gets the slop jar. Apparently, they didn't have plumbing upstairs. I'm not sure if they had plumbing downstairs, but they didn't have plumbing upstairs. So he gets the slop jar, which sits out in the backyard during the day, and he brings it up to the bedroom, and he sets it by the closet door, and he goes, lays down on the bed. So he's laying down on the bed, and this is Albin's story, the defense story. And as he lays down on the bed, he starts, oh, woe is me, she's leaving, and my marriage is falling apart, my life is falling apart. And all of a sudden, he realizes there's an insurance policy that he has on himself that would make Cecilia a beneficiary. I think it's a $1,000 policy. He's got to find that policy because he wants to grab that and change it to his mother, the beneficiary to his mother. So he looks in the dresser where he thought the policy was, and he couldn't find it. So then he goes into this closet, and it's a walk-in closet. It's about 5 feet by 8 feet. And I think I have been in that closet. I am not 100% sure if I was in the right house, but if it wasn't that closet, I've been in the closet of the house next door. And he goes in the closet and starts looking through the trunk. Okay, so the defense story then is that Cecilia comes upstairs and says, what are you going to do on this property? And Cecilia is carrying the potato masher upstairs. What are you going to do on the property? And Albin says, well, you can have half. And he and she swears at him, and she's got a salty language. She swears at him and says, I want it all. Well, only a court will give it all to you. You can have half. And then she looks down at him, what are you doing? And says, I'm looking for the insurance policy. And she swears at him again and takes a swing at him with the potato masher. So in this case, this scenario, she's the one swinging the potato masher. He wards it off. It drops to the floor. He grabs her by the neck, pushes her against the wall, and her head hits a old-fashioned wire hook on the wall. I remember my grandparents having a row of iron hooks on the closet wall. Her head hits that, and he's choking her. She falls to the ground. The kerosene lantern falls to the ground and breaks, and that's what catches her on fire. And Albin doesn't remember a thing that happened after that. at conveniently.
Yeah.
You know, and the newspaper reporters, one of the newspaper reporters said, you know, that's a believable story up to the point that he doesn't remember anything like that. You know, and he at one point he claimed that Cecilia was the one who had cut him up. And you know, some of the readers of the book have said, well, I think the boyfriend came and cut him up. You know, I've had two readers tell me that. I think the boyfriend came and cut him up. So, you know, the fire department comes because a neighbor sees smoke coming out of the window, and the fire department comes and the front door is locked, and so they find a ladder. There's a house under construction down the street. They find a ladder and rescuers start going in. Actually, this is before the fire department comes. The rescuers start going in, and they find Albin in a pool of blood on the floor in front of the window, between the window and the bed. And then the fire department and they pull him out of the house, which, you know, there's smoky room. They pull him out of the house, and he goes out through the front window. And then the fire department comes and they bring a hose up and a horse-drawn hook and ladder truck. And they open up the closet door because that seems to be where the fire's at. And they find this charred body in a cramped position on the floor. And the fire chief testified that she looked like a hard-baked chicken. And the newspapers softened that up. You imagine, and even what they wrote still would have upset people in the afternoon reading that right before dinner. But yeah, it looked like a hard-baked chicken. And her clothes were completely burnt off except for iron corset stays. And I think one of her earrings was, some of her jewelry was melting. I mean, it was really, really a brutal way to go. To be burned to death after the head wound. So, you know, there's arguments on both sides. Part of Albin's argument makes sense, and part of and the prosecution argument makes sense.
Well, now the sister had gone. She wasn't around then.
She had gone to get a livery to haul the trunks to the train station. I believe they were going by train. The train station was just a block away, but obviously they needed some help getting the trunks to the train station. So she was gone. The kids were at home, and this is curious. The little boy and the little girl, under Albin's story, when he was sitting on the front porch, the kids asked for money to get candy, and Cecilia, who was sitting inside the house, said, Albin, don't be stingy. Give him some money. So he gave them money, and a neighbor actually saw them leave Albin and head across the field or head down the street to get candy. So a neighbor saw them do that. But when the fire started and the next-door neighbor, Catherine Brand, when she saw smoke coming out of the window, she went to the house, and the little boy was in the house and at the back door, and he said he said something to the effect that there's been a fight. So I'm not sure how of the timeline here, how he would have gotten back inside if they did go to get candy. But I know, and this is fascinating to me, that the LaPorte newspaper reported a few days later that the little boy may have witnessed the murder. And the fact that the LaPorte newspaper said that makes sense to me, because if Gene took the kids back to Kingsbury, Gene might have been talking about this, and the kids might have been talking about it. So that's how the LaPorte newspaper would have been to report that. But one of the coolest things about my research was that I have met that little boy's son. And he lives in California, and My wife had suggested that I needed to, my wife is a professional copy editor and she read all 12 drafts of the book. And she suggested at one point I needed to find a little more color in the book. And I, you know, I don't know what happened to the little boy. And in 24 hours, I found the son, and in 48 hours, I was interviewing him. And we have met three times now. And so he's a new relative and we email about once a week. So, fascinating. But, you know, he, the little boy never said anything about it to any of the family, mm-hmm. because the murder was not known to the son.
Wow. But now, so he got arrested, was charged, right?
He was charged with first degree murder. And was indicted on multiple counts. The prosecutor, didn't miss an angle. You know, every kind of angle he could think of, he was charged with. But it took a while for the trial because Alvin was in the hospital for quite a long time in Epworth Hospital in South Bend, and the newspapers reported, one day he was going to die, the next day he was improving, back and forth. You'd have one newspaper report that he was dying, and the other newspaper would say he was getting better, and the story was being covered. There were two weekly newspapers in Mishawaka, one of which I didn't have access to the files, but two daily newspapers in Elkhart, two daily newspapers in South Bend, and two daily newspapers in LaPorte, and all of them covered this like a dog with a bone. So it was fascinating. But the trial was delayed. I think on his first court appearance, Alvin was carried into the courtroom on a stretcher, and Alvin was being treated, besides possible gangrene in his leg, he also was being treated for burns to his throat. So he ingested poison. It makes sense that he ingested poison, whether it was in the coffee or whether it was whether he drank from the bottle of iodine and glycerin in a suicide attempt. That was one of his ailments. But yes, he was tried. It was an exciting trial. Alvin testified. His testimony, his testimony took up 84 pages of the trial transcript. It was massive. The policeman, James Anderson, who had been at the intersection the night before, he was called to the stand four times. Neighbors were called to the stand. Trial went for 5 days, but the jury only took 4 or 5 hours to come to a verdict, and he was convicted of second degree murder, sentenced to life in prison. And you know, Jean could not be found for the trial. She was not a witness. She headed back apparently to Nevada where her husband was because he had discovered gold. And I think if Jean had testified, because Jean had witnessed Alvin's temper in all these cases. If Jean had testified, I think there's a chance that Alvin would have been convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to hang. I researched the other wife murders with finger quotes. There are wife murders of that decade in Indiana. And I found 5 cases of first-degree murder, and 3 of those 5 were sentenced to hang. So Alvin was very lucky that Jean was not present at the trial.
So he got put away. Did he ever get out, or was that?
Yeah, 16 years. Yeah, you know, that's pretty common. In the cases that I researched, if they didn't hang you, you got out after 16 years, regardless of what your sentence was. Apparently that was pretty common in federal cases too. But yeah, 16 years he got out. He was sponsored. His parole was sponsored by an Elkhart policeman who had broken up a fight when Cecilia was being choked by Alvin years before. But he sponsored him and put him to work in a restaurant. He was in the restaurant business for years. I think he even owned his own restaurant. He lived a long life. He lived to 84, 85. At one point, according to one of the relatives I met through my research, he may have worked as a door-to-door salesman, coffee and tea salesman, which was still still a little bit common even when I was young.
Yeah.
And this relative, her great aunt, you know, was scared to death when he came to the neighborhood because he knew his background.
Mm. And the kids, what happened to them? So if he got put away and the mother's dead, where did they go?
Well, William, my grandpa was already living with his father, and the father remarried and had a good marriage. That's who my mom knew as her grandparents, because my mom wasn't born until 1919. So that was 13 years after the murder.
Yeah. Wow.
And Lyle, I think, lived to 101. And I reread the book periodically, especially before an interview like you guys today. I reread the book and say, well, what have I missed here? What do I need to know? And Lyle didn't die until 1996, and she was 101. And I wondered, did my mom know Lyle? Because I didn't know Lyle. Did my mom know Lyle? Did my mom know that her aunt died that year? Is that the reason that she felt safe in telling me a little bit about the murder? You know, that's just something I came up with rereading the book last week.
Hmm. Yeah, there's so many angles to it, you know. You just, it's crazy. And, well, you know, 100 years from now, your offsprings will be writing about you.
Well, yeah, it'd be nephews and nieces, their offsprings.
Yeah.
Oh, now, I owned a newspaper, so I didn't have time to have kids.
Well, it's probably, yeah, it's okay. Well, so now, do you have a website or a place that you want people to come find out about you or your book?
I have a Facebook page. It's Gary Sosnicki - author. I have several Facebook pages, but that's one where I write mostly about the book. Gary Sosnicki author, Sosnicki. I'm also on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And, you know, all these things that you have to learn when you do your first book and you're in the middle of a pandemic. So I learned about Reddit, a lot of things. And of course, I bought a Zoom account. A lot of things I've had to learn.
Reddit's dangerous. I'm warning you.
Yeah.
Some real mean people there. Reddit and YouTube, look out.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, it's been fantastic.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure having you. And the book, and we're going to have, of course, your book and your website. We'll have it all linked to ours as well. So people
Thank you
can
very much.
Find you with one click.
Absolutely.
The book is called The Potato Masher Murder. And the author was our guest, Gary Sosnicki. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, guys.
Are you prepared? Legacy Food Storage. The best way to protect your family is by being prepared. Go now to legacyfoodstorage.com. Use coupon code HOM15 now for 15% off. Quick, go!
Find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.